These days, when you hear the word foodie, you might think of a food snob, somebody who likes only the finest of foods.
But there's another kind of foodie, one who eats more extreme delicacies like ants or horse meat. That's the kind of foodie we're talking about today.
So we want to know, are you a foodie in that sense of the word? What's the strangest thing you've ever eaten? Or would you eat just about anything? Do you have any peculiar tastes you'd like to share with us? Call in and tell us all about it. 800-642-1234, or you can wrap it up in an email, talk@WPR.org.
Dana Goodyear joins us now. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and The Making of a New American Food Culture. Dana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, first I want to ask you, what drew you to write about this topic?
I noticed that there was a spirit of adventurism around eating that hadn't really been present before. I also noticed that as a diner, going out to a nice meal was starting to feel less like a straightforward indulgence or, you know, a moment to be gluttonous, and more like a challenge to my senses, my morality, my sense of, you know, what I could tolerate physically, psychologically. So that I found really, really fascinating, that this repositioning of fine dining as an experience that involved adventure, danger, thrill, excitement, and a real challenge to the idea of what's edible.
Mm. Well, when did extreme eating become popular?
It is in some sense a recent phenomenon. We see this as the age of the internet has really accelerated it in so many ways, and actually the recession too, which I can talk about in greater detail. But the roots of this kind of eating go all the way back to the beginnings of gourmet in this country, which is around the time of World War II, when immigrants from Europe started to come to this country, start over with making new businesses out of importing specialties from abroad that they were familiar with from their lives in Europe. And, you know, exotic things like tinned tiger meat and barbecued baby bees and things like this were always part of that notion of specialty foods. Specialty foods also included, though, things that we think of as totally ordinary now, like Hawaiian punch or miniature corn or marinated artichokes. So our ideas about what's exotic and what's familiar are temporary, actually.
Mm-hmm. Let's dig into that. You mentioned that the recession might actually have influenced some of this this trend setting. How so?
Well, starting in around 2008, it became very, very hard for young chefs and even for some established chefs to have the kind of restaurants that were possible before the recession. So the four walls of the restaurant came down and people started to go on the road in food trucks. That movement started in L.A. and has spread to the entire country at this point. Pop-up restaurants in unused spaces or after hours, and let's say a restaurant only served lunch, then a chef would come and say, hey, let me do a 6-week pop-up here at night after, you know, ordinarily your doors would be closed, but I can use this space and I can make money and we can share the proceeds. People got really innovative. Underground restaurants became really, really common also. Those are restaurants out of people's apartments or unconventional spaces. And in all of those scenarios, especially the underground restaurant, that you can serve things that you can't serve in an ordinary context. The economic pressures on restaurants have created an opportunity for broadening in terms of what a chef is willing to serve, and experimentalism is really rewarded in that context.
Is there an economic drive for that? I mean, is there demand for that?
The foodies that you mentioned are really, really supportive of this, and they have to a large extent created this. They, led by some Pied Pipers like Jonathan Gold, who I write about, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic he won his Pulitzer at the LA Weekly, now he's at the LA Times, who introduced diners to the concept of going across town to neighborhoods where they didn't speak the language and going into small ethnic restaurants and eating the food and not being afraid that they would, not be served or would have a weird experience telling, he sort of told people, this is a great experience, this is a really fun thing to do. And then there have been a couple of other Pied Pipers, the more familiar Anthony Bourdain and Andrew Zimmern, and they have inspired a generation of young people to think of having adventures in food as really a central part of their social lives and their identities. So it's really a young person's movement. The idea of the gourmet, using that word in particular, is a really sort of mid-20th century notion, and a picture pops in your mind when you think of a gourmet. It's a sort of a fat cat, a rich white guy probably living in New York City, and a foodie can be anyone. And really, in my experience reporting this book, I met every single kind of person, but a lot of them young, and a lot of them from, you know, parents who are immigrants or grandparents who are immigrants.
Where did this phenomenon come from? Have you been able to pinpoint the origins of it?
Well, it does. I mean, as I said, it comes from, it's been embedded in our notion of specialty food since the beginning of that concept. But there's certain, with food, certain factors have to coalesce to bring something into the mainstream and to make something seem not like an exotic experience only for the the most daring people, but in fact part of common experience. And you know, a good example of that is sushi. So sushi had been known in this country, especially on the West Coast, because of the Pacific Rim. You know, in San Francisco and Los Angeles, people were aware of what was happening in Japan. There were a lot of Japanese people living in California. And in the 60s, a Japanese businessman who was based in California took one of his American partners overseas, and they were doing something else. They were actually looking for gadgets to import for American homemakers. And as a sort of as part of his hosting duties, he took his American partner out to a really great sushi dinner, and that fellow said, "This is so amazing. We have to bring this to the States. Everyone's going to love it." And the Japanese man said, "Absolutely not. They will not love it. It's raw fish. Americans don't eat raw fish. It's prepared in front of you. Americans are not used to that. And it's prepared by people not wearing gloves. And Americans are certainly not comfortable with that when you're talking about raw meat." And they gave it a whirl anyway, and that was the first sushi bar in this country. And then it took another 25 years before the L.A. vision of sushi was exported to New York and then to London, Moscow, Paris, but also then now we get it in every grocery store in America. So there is a process, but the factors that contributed, it wasn't getting that sushi bar to America. It was three things. It was the rise of the Japanese car, the popularity of the novel Shogun, and the rearrangement of the food pyramid to emphasize fish. So that's what made this Japanese delicacy that was considered really offbeat and really dangerous by many Americans, that's what transformed it into what we now see as a just, you know, it's a convenience food that we all enjoy pretty much.
We're talking with Dana Goodyear. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. She's got a new book called Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. What is the strangest thing that you've ever eaten? Do you consider yourself to be a fearless eater? And what is fearless eating anyway? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. We're continuing our discussion about food culture in the United States with New Yorker staff writer Dana Goodyear. She's also the author of Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture.
And we are taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. If you've got some extreme food stories that you would like to share with us, do you consider yourself to be a foodie and someone who likes that adventure of finding something new to eat. And what do you think Americans will be eating in the future?
Dana, I wanted to ask you, so insects are part of the menu in many other nations. Do you see that picking up here in the United States?
It's so provocative an idea. I wish I could say for sure that I thought in 5 years we wouldn't blink an eye. I think that the process, it could be sort of like that sushi model that we talked about, where it seems so outlandish, and then all of a sudden several factors coalesce to make it ordinary. So that could happen, and one of those factors might be this growing awareness that 80% of the world eats insects and really enjoys them, and that by 2050 they're projected to be 9 billion people in the world, and that's not a number of people that we can support conventional beef agriculture for or pork agriculture. So some of the pressures that people are beginning to be aware of talk about as the 20th century American way of eating, which is really resource intensive and really limited in terms of what species are being presented as food. People that may end up being one of the factors that makes insects a possibility. I think that in the Western world, there, we have some pretty deeply held reservations about eating insects. And the most fascinating thing that I heard about this was an entomologist who said to me, you know, mark my words, if we had insects the size of pigs in Europe, we would all be eating insects. But in Europe there were other options, and so the descendants of Europeans have often thought of eating insects as disgusting, because a lot of times food taboos emerge around foods that are considered beneath notice. So the same is true for horse, and the same is actually true for whale. So it can get pretty interesting and pretty complicated where our revulsion comes from. But most people have been told by their parents, you know, spider, or don't touch that. That could sting you. That could hurt you. And people have very negative experiences with insects. But it's not rational when you think about our willingness to, or a lot of people's willingness to eat arthropods, which insects are, that live in the ocean and unlike insects feed on the detritus at the bottom of the sea. I'm talking about lobsters and shrimp. And so we have these really illogical, irrational distinctions that we make. So rationally, insects make so much sense. Emotionally, it's difficult to imagine.
And you mentioned lobsters. Is that one example of a food that if we were to have this conversation elsewhere in the world and people were speaking of the American diet, is that one example of the so-called extreme diet of the United States?
I think it's something that people in other countries definitely find shocking. I've a couple of examples leap to mind, but one was that an anthropologist I talked to was doing research in Latin America, and the area where she was working was, I think, 100 miles from the shore. And the people in her region ate insects all the time, and they spoke with real horror about their brethren who lived 100 miles away on the coast, who ate shrimp. And when this anthropologist got some shrimp at a market and brought them home and was preparing them with the family with whom she was living, the daughters of the family left the room. The mother, who always helped her with the cooking, refused to participate. It was appalling to them. And so, you know, our preferences aren't, there's no gold standard around what we like. It's just what we like. And another interesting perspective on this whole idea of preference came to me from a marine ecologist who said, you know, we have these ideas that we have preferences and that we like things, but we actually like what we can get. And So I think it's worth looking at this idea that people are starting to talk about liking insects. It's the avant-garde, but it is out there. So what does that mean? Is that a reflection of awareness that that's a ready protein source and it doesn't create the same environmental problems as some of our other protein sources.
Let's try to work in a phone call real quick here. Alex in Madison. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I wanted to bring up some books by Ewell Gibbons. I believe he wrote these back in the 60s. I'm not exactly sure, but there's one called Stalking the Blue-Eyed Scallop and one called Stalking the Wild Asparagus. And in the Wild Asparagus book, he talks about, I mean, he talks about a wild harvest. Oh, 1971 is when it was reprinted. So, but he talks about in how acorns used to be a staple, ground into flour and used as food by indigenous people. And in the other one, he talks about how you can even eat barnacles, and he talks about recipes for sea cucumbers and things.
Thank you, Alex. We only have about a minute left. So, Dana, could you speak to that? Is there a connection between foraging, perhaps, and some of these more extreme diets?
Oh, definitely. And thank you so much for bringing up those books. One of the hallmarks of this new food movement is that the foods of poverty and of desperation are being recast as the foods of the elite and presented on very expensive tasting menus and in, you know, fine restaurants all over the country. And I think that that is actually absolutely what the foraging movement is about. And it is a survivalist way of eating. So what does it mean that the richest people in the world are starting to eat like survivors? To me, it connects to the fact of that our institutions are faltering and Americans are insecure about our place in the world, maybe for the first time ever.
Well, Dana, thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there as we're out of time. That was Dana Goodyear, a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Anything That Moves.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a flu expert about how this season is shaping up. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The news is next here on Central Time.